This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Someone recently wrote to me saying that he had listened to lots of Joko's Dharma talks, and that she over and over again kind of emphasizes kind of meticulous attention to bodily experience, bodily tension, the moments in daily life when we experience resistance. And her talks all seem to focus on the minutiae of practicing with awareness like that, in the name of loosening the grip of resistance in our life and thereby decreasing our suffering. That was sort of more or less the gist of what he got said from her talks, and I wouldn't disagree. And then he said, but you don't talk like that very much. Your talks are very different. Why is that? And I think that's also a fair question. It's not that in any sense I disagree with what Joko talked about. But my emphasis has changed over the years, and the perspective I try to teach has changed since her day. Just as the perspective that she taught was a break from that of her teacher. Now, her break was much more of a repudiation, but it's important to know that, you know, in that generation there was originally a sense of great excitement, idealization of Zen and Zen teachers, great infatuation with the idea of enlightenment experience, and a basic orientation of practice to producing Kensho experiences. And that the scandals that hit the New York Zen Center and San Francisco Zen Center were enormously disruptive, not just in terms of the personal tragedies involved, but were very disruptive of the kind of idealization and picture of practice that that generation had developed. And while that disillusionment came out of very painful experiences, it's also true that Zen in America never would have developed the way it did unless that disillusionment had occurred. Because that disillusionment gave rise to a much deeper level of psychological honesty and sophistication about what goes on in Zen practice, how it interacts with our daily life and our daily personality, and what we think of now as Western or American Zen or Buddhism has taken a distinct psychological turn that in large part was compelled by the crashing and burning of certain fantasies about the nature of enlightenment. See, I was reminded about this recently reading a little book on Nietzsche, and how as a young man who had lost his own father at an early age, he had developed an intense idealization of Wagner and imagined Wagner to be the embodiment of a great cultural turning point, really in the redemption of the culture through a kind of revitalization of myth and art. Nietzsche was a classical scholar and was looking for some way to have the power of classical myth and the whole culture of classical Greece form an antidote to what he saw as the failures of Christianity in contemporary Europe. And here was Wagner creating sort of these operas that embodied a whole new kind of myth, and there was a way in which he felt that art was going to, sort of capital A art was going to be this great redemptive force in the culture. And this project of Wagner's came to fruition finally with the festivals at Bayreuth, if you'll excuse my pronunciation, where finally, Wagner had this whole theater specially built for him where he could stage the Ring cycle. And when it finally happened, Nietzsche was profoundly disillusioned, because he saw that rather than this project being sort of a thumb in the eye of the bourgeoisie and an alternative to the dominant culture, all the powers that be just lapped it up. It was immediately assimilated and accommodated. And that Wagner himself became quite captivated by the role that he was able to take and the patronage he was able to finally secure and so forth and so on. And so rather than being this kind of, countercultural alternative for Nietzsche, suddenly there was a great disillusionment. And out of that disillusionment, Nietzsche went and spent a year down in Italy, Sorrento. And it was only there, in the sort of the from the ashes of that disillusionment, that his mature philosophy began to take shape. And he sort of gave up any thought about a kind of capital A art redeeming anything, and he developed a philosophy of the immanent and the temporal and the perishable rather than the pursuit of the eternal. See, in his own way, he had to go through the kind of experience we talk about when we say, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Wagner was his Buddha, right? He had something about that had to be sacrificed in order for him to move on and personally develop. But I think that in all of our practices, we will go through different versions of that. when you encounter it as a kind of koan, when you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, it makes it sound voluntary that you're going to encounter an ideal and you will make the choice to slaughter it, right? But it doesn't usually work that way. Killing the Buddha usually means passing through great disillusionment, right? A version of great doubt. Joko said the path to humility leads through humiliation. You know, and one version of that is a kind of crash and burn of your own sense of yourself and what you've attained in practice. Somehow, the inevitable hubris of attainment has to also crash and burn. I'm going back to the student who wrote me about why my talks are different from Joko's. Just as as she experienced a certain limitation in what Maizumi was teaching, the way Maizumi's picture of enlightenment did not engage the psychological problems of the students or himself. We have seen the next turn of the crank in the development of Zen go from a kind of new awareness of the psychological in Joko's day to a kind of medicalization or therapeutical turn in practice, which we might say is culminating in the popularity of the mindfulness movement, that the cultivation of psychologically oriented practices, not just to relieve suffering in the traditional sense, but to reduce stress and cope with problems and make our lives better and happier, has been a kind of turn that I think takes Joko's teaching down a whole unexpected byway, one in which her psychological mindedness became completely instrumentalized and became, people became preoccupied with techniques and results and what we can learn from brain scans and evidence-based, long-term studies. So for me, what gets lost on that particular byway is any sense of what makes this a religious practice and any sense of the idea of what no gain is all about. So in many ways, I think I return to the Heart Sutra where he talks about no path, no wisdom, and no gain. No suffering and no end of suffering. That whatever we mean by the end of suffering in this practice is not simply the amelioration of our problems. It's not a problem-solving kind of practice. In some way, it's about a more radical change in our relationship to our life and our suffering. And I think that gets lost if we turn practice into a series of techniques to deal with stuff, right? Basically, I think my talks and what I concern myself with is how we envision this practice intersecting with our life, what place it has in our life, and whether that place is now reducible to a kind of substitute therapy for people. And if it's not that, how do we conceptualize it? How do we think about how this is part of a form of life, a form of lay life? So if we took Dogen as our model for Zen practice, and I certainly take him as a model in many things, but his model of practice was one that was completely organized around a particular form of life. And if Dogen Zen was coming to America in a pure form or traditional form, it would mean establishing Soto monasteries here that replicated the asceticism and discipline and relationship to society that a place like Eiji does. And I think, you know, what you would get is that, you know, Zen, a Zen Buddhist monastery would then be a place like Gethsemane, you know, the Trappist monastery where Merton practiced. It'd be a place of great discipline and austerity cut off from the world. And you might get people like Merton who would be able to describe that life in a way that would appeal to millions of readers, but actually only a few hundred people would ever show up there and live that life, right? You know, after Merton wrote, there was a great boom in vocations in, you know, Trappist monasteries. They went from having dozens of people to hundreds of people, right? I mean, that over decades, right? So a pure Zen, in many sense, would simply go down that route. And it may be that there are many teachers who feel that bringing Zen to America is the establishment of a couple Gethsemane-like Zen centers that do the real thing, right? And everybody else can read the Buddhist equivalent of the seven-story mountain and do a little bit on their own and be at the periphery, but to establish Zen is to establish that form of life. See, I think that for better or for worse, but mostly for better, that model has gotten broken open. It's gotten broken open in a way that makes Zen accessible to all of us and in the midst of our life. It has become accessible in ways that have a lot of downsides of the kind that Sally Teasdale parodies, you know, when she writes about Omega. It can get silly. But that may be the price we pay if we're going to crack Zen open and make it available to the world. But whenever anyone new shows up here, I almost always, you know, begin by asking them, "What are you doing here?" And I think it's a very difficult question to actually answer, and very instructive for all of us to think about. What are we doing here? Are we trying to work through a particular problem? Are we trying to find a community to be part of? Are we trying to understand our life in a different way? Are we trying to change our life in a particular way by being here? Not so easy to answer, but I think that what I try to do in these talks is open up the perspective to that question. Just what do we think we're doing here?